The Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies presents the Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled Joseph Smith.
Anyway, here is a very important statement. It pretty well sums up everything I've been trying to talk about. It's quite a recent one, too. 1983. In a survey, well, it's not a survey, it's a large handbook of the title is Prehistoric Germanic Europe. Goes from Prehistoric Germanic Europe, beginning way back with the Aryan Nation, which is Upper Paleolithic, which is also Upper Pleistocene. One is anthropology, see, the other one is paleontology, the other geology. And which is, well, the Willendorf figurine goes back older than that, but it's the period roughly from 27,000 B.C. on, not 2700, 27,000 B.C. on. It goes right through the whole thing. It's very well documented, very full. It goes through the various periods. It covers all of Europe, too. Now, there are thousands and hundreds of thousands of artifacts now from those ancient times, and this is the very interesting conclusion these people draw at the end of their book. They go through the works. It's very, very good if you want illustrations and reproduction. From the material evidence surveyed, culture appears to be a collective attempt at providing answers to the questions posed by man about what? About his economic survival? About his dominance? Sex or something like that? Not at all. That's not what keeps it going at all. It's a very interesting thing because until now, of course, we being a materialistic society have always given a materialistic interpretation of it. Naturally, what primitive man was after was to save his life, was to avoid wild beasts and so forth, and to bash his neighbor over the head and all that sort of thing. Always for survival. Of course, that was always the first rule. But that isn't the point at all, as he says here. All this evidence, culture appears as what? Not from that, but from a collective attempt to provide answers to the question of man about his position in this life and the next life. That's the thing. If you can, now, as long as you have some, well, let's continue what he says. As long as a distinct set of answers was satisfactory, the distinctive aspects of the culture remained constant and offered that degree of continuity which made for stability. You had a stable, continuous society as long as they had something they would believe in regarding this life and the next life. But as soon as they lost that, of course, this is the age of sophistication and science is supposed to abolish those things. Of course, that's exactly what you get in Lucretius and the others. As long as they had that, they had continuity and stability. It appears, on the other hand, that experiment, innovation, and change are necessary, they're forced on them, are a response to inadequacy or outright failure in some sector of the culture, of the culture's general view of the world. If you can answer that, remember the big question, whether it means anything, you know what that is, it's important for the final. As long as they have some answer to that that satisfies them in any degree, the society, and this talks about world civilization, because it goes the same way throughout the whole world all the time. It's not localized. These ancient civilization primitives were not localized. You find the same culture, for example, the Mousterian, which we associate with Neanderthal and so forth. You'll find it clear from China to Soho Man. You'll find it at Tukuchen, and you'll find it in Ireland. You find it everywhere, of course, in Heidelberg Man and the rest. But they're world civilizations, and they hold their coherency. They have dispensations, as long as the dispensation is going. But when people lose their faith and don't have any particular plan, then they wander and stray off in all popular possible directions. It's the answer to that question that keeps you on an even keel. Otherwise, you're simply seeking for power and gain and influence or whatever you can get in the moment here. Well, now this takes us to Joseph Smith. This is that account I was talking about of the first vision of the spring 69 issue of BYU Studies, which they tell me you can still get it. It gives five different versions. This is the most important, the one of 1831-32. They have reproduced it here in the handwriting of Frederick G. Williams. And this is the part I want to point out about the first vision. We have our own version, and the Wentworth letter is always also included here, in our Pearl of Great Price. It's the last chapter and the most important. Ties everything together. At about the age of 12 years, my mind became seriously impressed. Notice he was very precocious, and all the accounts of his enemies from the time tell the same story. I collected an awful lot of them years ago in a book called The Myth Makers, all the various accounts of people who knew Joseph Smith from his enemies. Those who were not his enemies, a very good collection was collected by Andrus, by Hiram Andrus, under the name of They All Knew the Prophet. If you can get that, it's very good. There's 150 accounts of people. That's from journals and so forth, not written in response to anything, just their personal reflections in their lives about Joseph Smith and their connections and their knowing him and so forth. It's a very remarkable collection of documents. But the other one is the other side. But anyway, and they always tell this, that when he was very young, he was always thinking about things, asking questions about things, and was seen often walking in the woods, talking to himself and so forth, and they thought that was as Harding says, an evil, groveling, self-centered nature. He was planning more evil tricks as he wandered around talking and so forth, feeling people out, questions. About the age of 12 years, my mind became seriously impressed with regard to all important concerns for the welfare of my immortal soul, which led me to searching the scriptures, believing that, as I was taught, that they contained the word of God, thus applying myself to them and my intimate acquaintance with those of different denominations, and he did go around and converse with all the ministers, led me to marvel exceedingly, for I discovered that they did not adorn their profession by a holy walk and godly conversation agreeable to what I found contained in the sacred depository. This was a grief to my soul. From the age of 12 years to 15, I pondered many things in my heart concerning the situation of the world. This is the Abraham story, too, as you notice. Concerning the situation of the world of mankind, the contentions and divisions and the wickedness and abominations and darkness. What, in upstate New York in the 1820s, this was the condition of the world? What would he know about a wicked world? Well, he knew, all right. The contentions and divisions and wicked. And this is, you say, well, what a very negative, sour nature. But Joseph Smith was notorious for his sunny, cheerful, optimistic nature. He was everybody's friend. His worst enemy said he never heard him say an unkind thing about anyone. Very interesting. He said, oh, he told all sorts of lies, exaggerations, deceptions, everything else, but he never said an unkind thing about anyone. With all the provocation he had, imagine that. Well, that would be the acid test as far as I'm concerned. But he goes on here. Which pervaded the minds of mankind, my mind became exceedingly distressed, for I became convinced of my sins, and by searching the scriptures I found that mankind did not come unto the Lord, but that they had apostatized. The first mention of apostasy, you know, we don't have an article of faith. There's no mention of apostasy in the article of faith. It's not necessary. The article of faith is an assertion of positive doctrines, the things we believe in. The fact that other people are astray and wrong. If these things are true, then everybody else must be wrong. You don't have to include that as an article of faith. But he was aware of it, that they had apostatized from the true and living faith, and there was no society or denomination that built up upon the gospel of Jesus Christ as recorded in the New Testament. And I felt to mourn for my own sins and for the sins of the world, for I learned in the scriptures that God was the same yesterday, today, and forever, was no respecter of persons, for he was God. Now he describes the world which God has given us. This we get a lot of in the Pearl of Great Price, and then the world which men have made. What men have made of the world that God has given us. He looked around the world, and of course, upstate New York is a sublimely beautiful part of the country. It was gorgeous then, you can be sure. For I looked upon the sun, and also noticed the concern with cosmology, cosmic. He was talking about sun, moon, and stars here. I looked upon the sun, the glorious luminary of the earth, and I also the moon, rolling in their majesty through the heavens, and also the stars shining in their courses, and the earth also on which I stood, and the beast of the field, and the fowls of the heaven, and the fish of the waters, and also man, walking forth upon the face of the earth in majesty and in strength of beauty, whose power and intelligence in governing the things are so exceeding great and marvelous, even in the likeness of him who created him. And when I considered upon these things, my heart exclaimed, well hath the wise man said in his heart, as a wise man said, it is a fool that saith in his heart, there is no God. And my heart exclaimed, all these things bear testimony and bespeak an omnipotent and omnipresent power, who maketh laws and decreeth and bindeth all things in their bounds, who filleth eternity, who was and is and will be from all eternity to all eternity. And the interesting thing, this is the contrast to the world in which men had made, you see. When I looked upon the situation of mankind, the contentions, the division, the wickedness, the abominations, the darkness, the minds of God. They were mobbing and misbehaving at this time badly. We have very interesting from a woman, she was a revivalist. She preached in England and she preached in New England, especially around this part, on the Geneva Road and near Palmyra and so forth. And they gave her a bad time. The ministers, Nancy Towell was her name, Nancy Towell. And they kicked her around. These people weren't very nice if you disagreed with them. The divisions and wickedness, abomination, and the contrast with that, the stars, the glorious setting in which we're placed here. All these things bear testimony. And then, when I consider these things, and that being seeketh such to worship him, as worship him in spirit and truth, he wants to be worshipped. Therefore, I cried unto the Lord for mercy, for there was none else to whom I could go. The situation of Abraham, you see, he starts out, the world has stopped dead center. Who can ever get it moving again? There must be a cry below before there can be an answer above. You see, a stirring below, as the Talmud says. And the same way with the table. You do not ask for a blessing on an empty table. You set the table, then ask for the blessing. But there was none else to whom I could go. I did obtain mercy, and the Lord heard my cry in the wilderness. And while in the attitude of calling upon the Lord in the 16th year of my age, a pillar changes the age. A pillar of light above the brightness of the sun at noon came down upon me from above and rested on me, and I was filled with the Spirit of God. And the Lord opened the heavens upon me, and I saw the Lord, and he spake to me, saying, this is a direct quote, you see, it's indirect quotation in the other accounts. And he told me, he said to me, and so forth. But this is what he said, and it actually quotes him here. Saying, Joseph, my son, thy sins are forgiven thee. Go thy way and walk in my statutes and keep my commandments. Behold, I am the Lord of glory. I was crucified for the world and all those who believed on my name, that all those who believed on my name may have eternal life. Behold, the world lieth in sin at this time, and there is none that doeth good, no, not one. And they have turned aside from the gospel. They keep not my commandments. They draw near to me with their lips while their hearts are far from me. And mine anger is kindling against the inhabitants of the earth to visit them according to this ungodliness, and to bring to pass that which hath been spoken by the mouth of the prophets and the apostles. Behold, and lo, I come quickly, as is written of me in the cloud, clothed in the glory of my Father. And so on, and then he says, and my soul was filled with love. And that was his reaction. For many days I could rejoice with great joy. Lehi, remember, who was so depressed, and after he saw the vision, then he rejoiced. Even though the news had was bad, could rejoice with great joy, and the Lord was with me, but I could find none who would believe the heavenly vision. Nobody would believe him. This is a situation in a dispensation. But without that to go by, as this survey, well, that's by Herbert Schutz, incidentally, the book is. Without that to go by, it says any civilization, world civilization, simply crumbles and dissolves. Remember what the poet says, what Yeats says, things fall apart, the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. Things fall apart today, the center can't hold, everything is dissolved. And that's the only difference, you see. We don't have a central doctrine, don't have the gospel to believe in. Well, now the question, this one, how does the Pearl of Great Price testify to the mission of Joseph Smith? I think we need to write that down, or we could write it down. Notice, testify to it, not for it or against. It can be either one. Remember, the Pearl of Great Price, especially the Book of Abraham, was taken for years and years, and still is, as the number one evidence against Joseph Smith, as overpoweringly strong evidence against him. We go into that, into quite a song and dance in the era, back in 1968 and so forth. See, we might as well mention some things here, because this is relevant. We overlooked this part of it. Of all the, in 1912, S.A.B. Mercer, there's a character, it was Chicago, of course, S.A.B. Mercer, was put in charge, was spearheaded an attack which initiated with Bishop Spalding of Salt Lake, the Episcopal, Franklin S. Spalding, the Episcopal Bishop of Salt Lake, wrote letters. Well, he got Mercer, who was a 32-year-old minister, who wanted to be an Egyptologist. Oh, how he wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And he was never very good. In fact, he was terrible, we know, because he sold us his library, his notes, and all that sort of stuff, and we see how ignorant the man was. It was just to laugh. But the point was, he was to spearhead this attack on Joseph Smith. Well, around 1953, was it? I'd just come to BYU. He had retired, from Toronto, and he collected a great Egyptian collection there, books, library, and he offered to sell it to the BYU for practically nothing. And Taylor was our, Tyler was our librarian then. He went back to Paris to see him to ask if he was really kidding, and no, he wanted the Morans to have this library after he had this vicious attack on it and so forth. And Harvard immediately came up with offered four times the sum, but we got it. We have the Mercer collection here, which is the core of a very good Egyptian library, one of the few in the country that could really be used for advanced study. And so he was in charge of this, and this was very carefully engineered. He sent the letters to a lot of Egyptologists. He got answered from 8 very eminent ones, and say, this is what Joseph Smith says, is he right? Instead of saying, what does this, sending the 3 facsimiles, you see, what do these facsimiles denote? Well, none of them agreed, none of them knew what they had denoted, but they just had one answer to give. Was Joseph Smith right in his interpretation? All I had to do was say no, because none of them believed that Abraham had ever lived. Now, if you're going to say, is this a true autobiography of Abraham, and ask a man who firmly believes there never was an Abraham, what answer is he going to give you? These are the people that tested it, and this is an amusing thing. The answers were very good, actually. Brother Witzel and R.C. Webb and others answered back with some very pointed things, showing they disagreed among themselves and so forth. But since that wasn't their particular field, these people naturally had a field day. Here's an editorial in the church newspaper. They point out that there are some obvious contradictions and discrepancies in the views of the experts, and the Mormons might be at least permitted to ask for a stay of final judgment, as B.H. Roberts wrote then. He says, these questions that depend on special scholarship are questions that require time and research, and the conclusions of the learned in such matters are not as unchangeable as they seem. And the New York Times exploded when it read that. They had a big headline, scarehead, that says, the headline is, the Deseret Evening News has spent its entire editorial page reviling scholars and scholarship. Mormons revile scholars and scholarship. Just because they asked some perfectly natural questions, that was reviling scholars and scholarship. It was pure authoritarianism, nothing else. These are the authorities. Well, they used this, and then remember when the church got the Joseph Smith documents in 1967, then they brought all this up again, then the big 1912 thing and so forth. They say these authorities were the ones. They said this, that, and the other. And 2 days after this, incidentally, the Deseret News showed the position the church took then and still takes. Bear was very much impressed because the fact, as soon as the church obtained the 11 fragments of the Joseph Smith papyri, they published them in very good. They sent slicks around, and they every one of them, without any comment or anything else, made them available to everybody and asked anybody to have any comments they wanted about it. Ask Egyptologists or anyone else. We've never argued with them as far as that goes. Well, that's exemplary. Nobody ever does that in Egyptian. When you got a document, you hug it to your bosom until you edit it, et cetera, and live for the next 10 years on it. But this was really impressive. But this is the policy the Deseret News states. It says the Latter-day Saints court inquiry such as this. They want to know the truth and only the truth. There's no important issue that they're not glad to face, whether presented by friend or foe. Now, you can present in this, testify to the mission of Joseph Smith, you can say that there are things you find in the Pearl of Great Price that would show that Joseph Smith must be faking, or that where he must be getting this, that, or the other. But they thought they really had him dead to rights in this. Way back in 1845, this is... 45 is very soon, you know, when you consider that the first attempt even to decipher it was 1838. This was only 7 years later. They hadn't got the first base at that time, but this is what they say about Joseph Smith's and the facsimiles in the Book of Abraham here. Well, all these figures in the facsimiles are familiar and now understood. They confidently defy, Joseph Smith in coming out with these things has confidently defied inevitable exposure. The Champollions of the Bibliothèque de Rey, of course they got that completely wrong, it's not, no such a bibliothèque, and the British Museum have the subject well in hand. It's already apparent to the learned that the whole thing is too gross to bear patiently, too painful to laugh at. Just don't even consider the experts, they just brush it aside. And then, an interesting thing here. Mercer says, quite frankly, this comes a little later here. We'll go into a lot of spiel about this. Well, that should have settled the matter with the authorities, but of course the Mormons were not convinced and would have done well to have done a little study on their own. In fact, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young both said now, well, Parley P. Pratt especially was strong on this, now this is a signal that we should get going and do something on our own here. This is an invitation to look further. They pointed the way for Latter-day Saints to prepare themselves for just such eventualities, pleading with them to take heed of themselves and use their brains. Even during, I noticed Brother Maxwell recently said that we can expect new documentary discoveries because they have been promised, they're part of the prophecies. Even during the grim days of December 1844, the leaders of the church advised the elders to get up schools that all might be taught in the branches of education and prepare themselves, at the least might be fully competent to correspond with the wise men of the world and so forth. But they neglected it because they were very busy with other things. Now this Mercer, who entered this enterprise in 47, 1912, and this was all revived, of course, and all republished by the Salt Lake Lithograph and companies got up by the Tanners, and they make a big thing of it. So it's highly funded from various parts and so forth. There are still Walters, people like that, traveling around giving lectures on and making a lot of money. Not here, but in Arizona and back east. And this night before last, I met with four people from Denver, where the pressure is really on there because they're building a temple there now and they make a big thing of it. And here, Dr. Merker frankly admits that he and the other scholars, quote, did not seem to take the matter very seriously and devoted very little time to it indeed. Now, they were supposed to pass their judgment on it. They said, well, it's just nonsense, but they didn't bother to read it because it's not necessary. You say Joe Smith and that's all there is to it. You've tipped your hand and there's no argument. But, and then he says, the haste was justified in the minds of the scholars by the simplicity of the task. Even less time could be expected. They probably felt as I did, says Mercer, that their time was too valuable to spend on such scientific work as the Joseph Smith guesses. Whatever the reasons, they never intended to do any real work. They depended entirely on their credentials to get them through. And this is the sort of thing that's been going on for 150 years now. And we let them get away with it. But we have lots of evidence here. Now, we're talking incidentally about the subject here. Again, how does the Pearl of Great Price testify to the mission of Joseph Smith? It's a subject that has very broad latitudes. You can write from many points of view and so forth. It's just how good the essay is. Remember, your consideration. From a doctrinal point of view, historical, philosophical, literary, scientific, you name it. And there's internal evidence and external evidence. As Friedrich Blau says in his classic work on the criticism of documents to determine their antiquity, whether they're genuine or not, you rarely ever have to use any external evidence for the Book of Mormon, Pearl of Great Price, or anything else. He says, in testing ancient, he's not talking about them, of course, he's talking about ancient documents in general. This is a massive volume on the subject. The first rule is that you don't, in the first place, the fact that you have the document, you must give it the benefit of the doubt. That's the very first thing. But the point he makes here is that the evidence is internally. You rarely have to go outside of the internal evidence of the document itself. You don't need anything else. You don't have to refer to the time, to its setting, to anything else. Well, you know those things. They're important. Now, we haven't done anything at all in as far as external evidence is concerned. We mentioned other sources for Enoch, other sources for Abraham. Some of them match, which ones match, which don't match. Well, that's a long story. You can take a lot of time on that. We haven't had time for that. Remember, we've been talking about the general thesis here. But the thing which I'd be concerned with, if I was writing this, of course, would be the internal evidence. Remember, how many books do we have? What do they pretend to be? What do they pretend to show forth and so forth? What kind of a feat is this? What kind of an accomplishment is this? Again, Brother Maxwell calls it an Everest, remember. Anyone who could set up a thing like that, what about a few mistakes and slips there and there? And how do you know they're mistakes and slips and all these other things? Well, we have the criticism, that's an interesting story, and we go into long things, we would never bother to do it again. But then we said we'd have a review here. Well, here are the various lessons you've gone through, and there are 26 of them, and Each one had a subject more or less, and they're connected more or less. Remember, the first one was what? The first lesson was what was the main concern of religion? This could be a perfectly legitimate question to write an essay for the final. What is the main concern of religion? As indicated in the Pearl of Great Price, you could use the Pearl of Great Price as your text, or what is the main source of our religious knowledge? And we get it from what's the type? Of course, then we talked about definitions of religion and the like. What's the source of our knowledge, and what serious defects are there in our knowledge, and what's the result of them? We made a big thing of this. In the religion of Israel, what's defects, what's missing in the books, and in the religion of Christ, in Christianity? What's the evidence? How do you know these things were lost? What evidence do we have these things were lost? You provided some of that. And what has Joseph Smith restored? What does the Book of Mormon restore? What does the Pearl of Great Price restore? This restores some very interesting things, and we talked a lot about them. Well, in others, for example, beginning with this in the second lecture, the literal sense of things. Remember, why was the literal sense of the scriptures rejected? You have to give some kind of a gesture. Okay? Well, why would they do that? Why wouldn't they accept them as literal? And what is the big question? Talked a lot about that. Remember Clement of Rome? Asking the big question wherever he went, couldn't, how it's connected with other things. Remember, it's necessarily cosmological, deals with the creation and all things. But the main thing is, what's going to happen to me? Where was I? And so forth. And why does this big question overshadow all the others? That's the big one. And can you give some examples, literary and historical, of this, of the big question? Well, it's wherever you look, you'll see it. You see the men. Men are haunted wherever you go. Why are they behaving so desperately, so hysterically, so irrationally everywhere throughout the world today? This takes us right back to our original thesis here from this recent survey of prehistoric Europe. As long as people have some satisfactory answer to the questions regarding the position in life and the next life, the society will keep going, people will go along and will not become desperate. See, it's because the Egyptians had a pretty good answer to that, and this accounts for the unique stability of Egyptian society. You can see that, because they never changed it. They never lost it. They were always naive. They left the door open. They knew they didn't have the answer, but they felt they had enough tradition, and they had enough evidence on hand to justify a grand jury and say, yes, this thing is worth a test. But remember, with positivism was the word invented by Auguste Comte in the middle of the 19th century. That is the positivism of science. What you see, what you hear, what you can feel, what you take in the library, that's real and true. And all the rest is myth and superstition, and it is vicious. It's not a thing that you want at all. So positivism will not allow any of this. See, the other side, on one hand you have the superstition of religion, the other hand you have the light of science, that these things absolutely as they are, and they still go very strong, actually. A person like Carl Sagan is rabidly positivistic, and so is most of science and so forth. Remember that passage from C.P. Snow about the great physicists of his time, Rutherford and so forth? They were positivists. They knew they had the answer, and they knew just as surely as they lived, just as surely as they knew Rutherford's atom, he says, that they were all destined for annihilation and were going nowhere. And when they were in public, they presented a brave front, but to themselves, they were panicky. The dark night was over them, and they had not only moments of doubt, but men at times, remember, are sober. They think by fits and starts, and when they think, they fasten their hands upon their hearts, because we don't escape that at all. It comes to everybody, comes strongly. Worried, of course, Darwin sick. He almost became a mystic in his last days. There's a very good book on that by, not Roland, but... Malraux, French writer, yes. Well, then, that was this one, this literalism that they got rid of. Why did they get rid of it? And Joseph Smith brought it back. And then the third talk, we talked about pre-existence. This has to be part of the picture. It's central. Why, we could ask this, say, as the question for the final. Why is pre-existence central to the discussion of religion? What is the present and Christian and Jewish attitude through the teaching? Well, it's coming back, actually. But why? Why were they against it? And what evidence is there for or against a pre-existent? I guess you can quote Wordsworth there. Our sleep, the sleep in the beginning and so forth, but you have better evidence for that. You know, Plato's anamnesis, we mentioned that, the memory, everything we know is a memory of what we learned before. We know what's right and wrong because it's implicit in us. Anamnesis, a memory of former times, and Zinzendorf, the poem, and so forth. Well, what was the early Christian view of it? Remember we read that poem called The Pearl, and how he leaves his heavenly home? When I was, he actually begins by saying, in my first primeval childhood, he was raised by his parents in the palace, he came down here, got into trouble and went back, was welcomed by the people back home. Well, then, the fourth and fifth them. If you're getting pre-existence, and if it's literal and pre-existent, that means you've got to take the cosmos into it. And cosmism is considered a great crime in Christianity and Judaism alike. The rabbis and the fathers of the church both condemn it, cosmos, the physical cosmos, that's hermeticism, that's Pythagoreanism and so forth. But why is it basic to religion? They can't get away from it, of course. Genesis 1 is what you get. What is the present attitude towards what they call cosmism or cosmology, and why? And why does the Pearl of Christ make such a big thing of it? What evidence is there for the concerns of the primitive for cosmology? Well, any references we have to the primitive, their stone circles or their glyphs, their drawings, all indicate their awareness of the four regions and the processes of nature and their observance of the sky and so forth. They're very much centered in the four directions and their dances, and which they left behind in stone, but they still are. You go down and visit the Hopis and Zunis now and you see cosmology. That's some terrific cosmology things. The visiting star, they go down in the Kiva, and a fellow comes in with a big silver star on his head, and he comes down the ladder. He says he's a descent from another star. And very dramatic things they do, but the cosmology is with them. Well, so we have megaliths and temples, just like our own. And what about the religious elements that appear in science fiction? Why would they be significant for this course? Look at the titles of science fiction books and so forth. What makes science fiction interesting? The fact that it's plausible that there are other worlds that people might visit, there are troubles among them and so forth. It goes back to the old theme, councils in heaven and so forth. You have high councils meeting in other worlds, and you have wars between the worlds, and you have the evil. Well, we have the good influence and the bad influence and that sort of thing, the good guys and the bad guys, the dark side and the light side. The Seed Acher, as it's called in the Kabbalah, in the Jewish mystics, the Seed Acher is the other side. There is the other side of things. Well, all these things are the sum and substance of science fiction because they have no ideas of their own. All they can do is draw on the scripture, and you'll see all throughout, you'll see the most popular ones are those like Star Wars and so forth, are those that have that element of plausibility. And it starts out, of course, in a galaxy far away and long ago. You see, this sort of thing could happen. But we've been teaching these things have always been happening. Not such things like this. There's always been something going on. So cosmology is a big thing here. Then the big question, the sixth lecture was on this subject. Why was the creation and still is creation the number one issue of controversy today? Creation, it's the most important. Why would they consider that the most important of all? But once we're here, we're here. That's the main thing, you see. But why be so exercised about how we happen to get here if you don't know? Just accept the fact that you're here and go on from there. As Professor Wormwood used to say up at the U of U, Mormonism is the only non-speculative religion. We don't ask, is it right that we should be here, or why were we, or were we created at all? Well, of course, this is problems of solipsism and entomology and so forth. Do I really exist, or should the world be here? Well, I don't know, but it is here, and we begin with it as a given quantity. It's not speculative. That's what you speculate about, things like that. But, and what is our clash with fundamentalism? What's the clash of Mormonism with fundamentalism? Well, you know what that is there. We don't believe things were created instantly, simultaneously, that all things instantly came into existence out of nothing, not at all. That's the fundamentalist view. That's the standard view of creation, which is why the science objects to it. Well, where do we clash with science? Where do we clash with Darwinism there? We say, remember, it is both a process and it is a plan. And they say, of course, there's no processing and there's no plan. It just happens. Only process would be chance, pure chance. Both coming into existence and the whatever progress takes place after that is pure chance, one way or the other. So we don't agree with either one of them. And but why do we take sides? Just the same. There's a psychological study you can go into, see. How does the pearl of great price answer both of these? And remember, we read those passages from John Gordon Bennett and William Bartlett, the Eastern editors, how Joseph Smith impressed them, and it was especially his cosmology that impressed them enormously, because it wouldn't accept either side. How can ancient writings contribute to scientific support of Joseph Smith? How could they? We have a lot of them. Well, we come to the seventh lesson then. What is the concept of beginning in the Christian world? That is, beginning out of nothing. That's important, because this takes us to the council in heaven. Where is the council in heaven described in ancient writings? Well, in all sorts of ancient writings it's described. We went into this one, the Shabako Stone, the oldest book in the world, and that's what it told us about, was this council in heaven of the creation of the world. And it was not mumbo-jumbo or primitive superstition at all. It was a very rational and important document. It still is regarded as still having powerful influence on Jewish literature and on Christian literature alike, down to modern times. But what's the rationale of the council in heaven? Why did they have it? What's the reason for it, and so forth? And the implications in the Shabako text with regard to cultural and religious evolution and the sources of the pearl of great price. What's the implication there? Well, then the eighth is still the Memphite theology. And we compared it with the Enuma Elish. Remember, that's the Mesopotamian version of it. What are the main teachings in the Memphite theology and in the Enuma Elish? And in the 11th lesson, what are the precious things removed from the scriptures? We're back to that issue again. Who would do such a thing? By whom? Who removed them? And why would they possibly remove them? When did they remove them? We know very well when they removed them. The councils of the church are very plainly dated. Where did it happen? And how did it happen? Well, these processes are all well known, but that's of course in Christian history, in the early church, actually. What is the Hermetic tradition? And then we talked about those permutations, the eight religious permutations, different philosophies and so forth. Remember, the light, the dark, light, dark, the dark, dark, the light, light, and so forth. There are eight, like the Chinese Qi Ling, there are the eight possible combinations. Which one are we, and why are we the only one that has all three alike? And what is the standard? The standard, what is the one the world usually accepts of those three? Remember, a bright pre-existence, a bright world, or a bright hereafter? You can rearrange those in eight different combinations, you see. But there's a tragic combination, there's the standard, there's the Pythagorean or mystic, there's the convention Judeo-Christian, there's the monastic, there's the romantic, and there's the gospel. Well, 12. Why should this stop? And then we have the doctrine of plurality of worlds. That goes along with cosmology. I shouldn't have moved here. I keep watching the clock for a reason here. Why should the plurality of worlds be a major issue in religion or in science? What's its place in the gospel? And what are the classic arguments for it and against it? That's a good subject there. That's a good subject for final. You could look that up everywhere, you see. And how does it relate to the pre-existence? And how does pre-existence relate to the problem of evil? Now, this is the problem that no religion solves at all. The Pearl of Great Price is the only one that really handles it, really comes to grips with it. What religious issues are raised by geology, cosmology, biology, psychology? We know those. And how does the Pearl of Great Price meet them? What is the connection that scientists are making between religious beliefs and quantum physics? You can get in one of those books by Gary Zukov or Friedhof Korda or someone like that. And then the 15th one was creation. How can there be a new world on old ground? Remember, new world, we believe the episodic idea, which is very important, is chronology. The big issues about chronology, they always talk about the time. Is the earth only 6,000 years old? What a fuss, what a thing to make about it. What's the significance of the tektites, of the iridium layer? What are the main phases through which the earth passes in the processes of creation according to the Pearl of Great Price, and the geological process, and then it goes through the biological phases, the Pearl of Great Price again. Remember, the beginning of a particular phase. And at what moment does creation begin? And at what moment does creation end, as a matter of fact? Then, what is the significance of the mountain in religion as an image, in reality, and so forth? And then back to First Moses, how does Moses chapter 1 apply to individual human beings and so forth? And then what are ascension texts? 18th, we talked about them, what takes place in the prologue in heaven and the role of Mephistopheles. What are the main acts and scenes in Moses 1? Because it's a drama. What is the argument of the play? How does it resemble the classic year drama? What's the purpose of handing down this account? The 20th lesson was on Moses 3:19. What light does the pearl of great price throw on primitive man? Where is the line between man and animal? When do you step over the line? See? What are the timeless episodes in the Book of Moses? They're timeless periods in which time is not measured at all that way. And then we come to the Lamech story. Why is that significant? Of course, there's the Cain and the problem of evil here. What is the pact with the devil? Who made it? What was Cain's motive? What was his message? What was his defense? And then what was Enoch's mission? Who were the watchers? Why is baptism central to the Book of Abraham, etc.? And what evidence is there that supports the authenticity of the Book of Enoch? And what's the message of the Book of Enoch? I know that. And what was the last straw that brought on the flood? Hamas, violence, of course. How does Noah repeat the experience of Adam as he does? And how does Abraham resume the work of Noah? Well, the time is up now, and I have to, by law, I'm required to distribute these things, and you're required to fill them out, and I'm required to leave the room. And what is the basic pattern of dispensations presented in the Pearl of Great Price? And why must the founder of each dispensation stand alone? Why are his instructions binding on others? What were the trials of Abraham, the merits of Abraham, the merits of every dispensation Abraham is typically, you see, and how does each dispensation end? Well, we're dealing with this dispensation thing.